Hello and welcome to this episode in our series, Conversations from the Classroom. In this episode, we speak to English teacher Patricia Carlos from St. Colman's Community College in Middleton, County Cork. Patricia talks to us about developing a reading and writing culture with her students and providing support and engagements for students at Level 2 and Level 3 in the Mixed Ability English Classroom. We hope that you enjoy. Patricia, thanks so much for sitting down with me today. Lovely to get this opportunity to chat with you. Could you tell me a little bit about your school context and what your experience is with Junior Cycle English to date?
I come from a pretty big DESH school. It's mixed. There's 956 students at the moment. Our classes are mixed ability across the board. So in an English class at Junior Cycle, you can have everything from L2 LP to a student who's going to get a distinction at higher level. So I've been teaching Junior Cycle since it came in. It was a change at first. Teachers are always a little bit slow to adapt to change. We're great at getting on with this, but we like to grumble a bit at the start. So I'm really enjoying it. I do enjoy, there's a little bit more flexibility and there's a little bit more creativity in it. And I'm really enjoying that.
And you mentioned the diverse cohort of students that you engage with on a daily basis. Are there particular strategies that you find are helpful when engaging those students in reading or writing, for example?
I would think personally, in terms of the diversity of our groups, I would always wait to decide on my pieces. So in terms of my texts, in terms of the novels, or even in terms of the films or the poetry, I would always wait to meet the students. Because just because on paper a student has a diagnosis or a particular special educational need, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not going to be able to enjoy something or access it because they have an interest in that. So I would always wait to meet my students so that I can make sure that all of them are going to access it and all of them are going to enjoy it. Because I do think it's important to get to know a group before you choose a novel, because you can get it wrong. You can completely get it wrong. I'm doing Where the Crawdad Sings with fifth years, which is probably an example. And the boys love it, the girls hate it. So I thought it would be the opposite way around. Sometimes it's better to get to know a group before you choose the text. So like with my third years at the moment, we did this one summer in second year as part of their junior cycle and they loved it. And I have three L2 LPs. I have a kind of small cohort of ordinary level and then I have a larger cohort of higher level. And the higher level were a little bit sus about a graphic novel in terms of studying it for the exam. But all the content is there, just because it's not paragraphs and chapters and things like that. All the content is there and they've all been able to access the text. They've all really enjoyed it. It still has the controversial themes and it has all of those. But it also means all my students are reading the same novel together, which is great. So it's brilliant.
Absolutely. And how have you personally found teaching a graphic novel? Because I suppose I'm conscious that there are some teachers that may be listening that might be nervous to approach that particular art form or that particular type of text. How did you find it?
At the start, I suppose, because I have such a diverse group in the class, I was looking for a novel that was going to address everybody's needs. And the graphic novel ticked the box, but I'd never thought a graphic novel before. I won't lie, I was a little bit apprehensive about how am I going to approach this. Normally, it's great because you can do the character development and you can lay it all out and there's probably resources online. It's exactly the same. You still have your character development. You still have your themes developing throughout. It's just shown in a different format. So I explained to the lads, it's like the step between a text novel and a film. So it's just in the middle. It's like almost like the storyboard that the person who wrote a novel creates for the film. So we've just broken it down, but you're still teaching the exact same things. It's just that it's shown in a different way in the book. And I think they enjoyed it because we did a text novel as their second novel, which was very different. We did Stone Cold. But again, you have teenage problems and the challenges that face teenagers. So they can still compare them very quickly. So I suppose it's the content rather than the format that it's shown. It's still all there. You just have to get your head around the fact that it's not words on the page. It's pictures. But no, I was apprehensive. But once you get into it, it's just as easy, maybe even easier, actually, because the kids pick up on things even more in the pictures than they would in the text, which is great.
As you mentioned there very briefly, there are some maybe slightly more controversial issues that are raised. Yeah. I suppose naturally in all texts that we encounter, did you find that you had a particular way of approaching that with your students?
I don't mind controversial things. I'm one of those teachers who doesn't mind dealing with the difficult things. I teach RSC at junior cycle and senior cycle, so I've no issue with those kind of things. But I think sometimes we underestimate what teenagers actually do understand and what they know what's going on in the world and things like that. I would be always with any text that I have that might have something controversial. I start with that before we ever even get into the text. Let's have a conversation about it before we start. It's better to do that, I think, than to happen upon it as we go through the book. Because the kids, firstly, I think it creates a bit of suspense. They're waiting for the controversial things to come up. So there's a little bit of excitement. When is it going to come? When is it going to come? But it also will throw up issues if you've picked the wrong book at the start. So if you have a kid who says, actually, miss, I don't agree with this, I don't feel comfortable discussing that, you know, from the beginning, you have someone you need to look out for in the class instead of happening upon it midway through a novel. So I always feel for the controversial issues that come up, it's better to address them before you start than to have to address them mid-novel.
Can I ask you, when it comes to writing, how do you motivate students to write in your classroom? Are there any particular strategies that you use?
So with first years, we've dedicated Friday to reading for pleasure or a flash fiction Friday. So we do a combination between the two. In my classroom, they either bring a book from home on a Friday and they read it and I ask them about the story, but there's no formal review or anything like that. It is actually just reading for pleasure. Or you have the option to do Flash Fiction Friday, which is everybody who's decided to do the writing bit gets an unusual topic put on the board and they get to write for 20 minutes. They get 10 minutes to edit it and then they submit it. And I don't go at it essentially with a red pen. It's really just writing for the sake of writing. So it's like the reading for pleasure, but we do share them. And part of the Flash Fiction Friday then is we have a creative writing club that meets on a Friday and they do the exact same. So it would be the same topic. And in the creative writing club, you first to sixth years. And each year then at the end of the year, we publish a little booklet. The students choose their best Flash Fiction Friday. And what we do then is we put in the titles and all the different versions of those titles get put in. So the kids get to see their work printed and it's really good. I know in the creative writing club, because we've such a mix, we have horror writers and we have poets and we have all of those kind of things. The kids read them to each other and then they start to give themselves, you know, feedback. So the peer feedback there and the peer correcting and editing and those kind of things is brilliant. For the first years in the flash fiction, we tend to keep it a little bit less about correcting and drafting and more about just writing and trying to work on being descriptive and things like that. But it helps because they don't like to write. So it's nice to give those who do like to write an opportunity to do it and those who just want to have a go, they get to have a go.
Do you find that the publishing element, and I suppose it's almost community editing because they're peer editing one another, but do you find that kind of process that's leading to a publication at the end in this particular instance, has that had a really big effect on the students?
I would think, especially for a creative writing club, it has, because lots of kids get to play on the sports team and get a medal, or they've gone to the county and they've lost in the quarterfinal and it's announced on the good news on Friday over the intercom. This is their opportunity to show off their skills. So like lots of the kids that I have aren't sporty or they aren't involved in some of the other things in school. This is their thing. And it's nice that at the end of the year, there's something they're getting recognition for. And what's really nice is the teachers get a copy. So like a teacher will say, oh, I read your story. It was really good. Or I read your poem and it was brilliant. So it's an opportunity for them to succeed. And I suppose for writing, and if you have an ambition to be a writer, having something published is, that's the goal. That's the ultimate, you know, I've had something published in a booklet, people are reading it. So it's an opportunity for success for them. And there isn't the pressure as such that you would have in a real writing goal, but they still have to meet a deadline and they still have to make sure that they've edited it and they've made sure that they've done their punctuation and their capital letters and their grammar is good. It is the writing process. And they have a publication after it. It's an opportunity for success, but also an opportunity for them to show off their skills.
And there might be a few teachers listening to this who are thinking, I really want to do that. I want to put together my students' work and I want to try and publish it. How did you go about it? Even in terms of the practical steps that you took, Did you need help from different departments, or were you able to collate the material yourself?
In theory, you think it's going to take a lot of time, but it actually doesn't. So for Creative Writing Club, we're a Google school. So we have a Google Classroom that is our Creative Writing Club. So if someone misses out on a Friday, they can still work away on the title for the Friday at home. So they submit all their stories through a document under that assignment on the Friday. So I have access to all of their material immediately. And then they have access also. So like I've used them to help me put it together. So we're literally putting it together in a document and creating a booklet. It is tricky the first time. It is tricky. But once you get the format and the layout and you know how things run, it becomes really easy. Like it's something that you can literally put together in an hour or two. And then literally we've been printing it at school and we have been going to the art department to put a cover on it for us. So they've designed the cover for us. And then they have a colour printer. So they print a series of covers and then we print out one, put it in the photocopier, and then it's folding and stapling and things like that. So it might seem like it's a really hard task, but if you have anyone that knows their way around Canva or anyone who knows their way around IT, nab them. I happen to be on our IT group, so I love Canva and I've the new document section is brilliant. And we've done workshops with the kids then with Canva so that they know how to put things together. So the first year, myself and one of the fifth years and sixth years put it together. But from first to sixth year now, they all know how to use Canva and they all know how to create the document. So they could nearly do it themselves. They just need someone to mind them.
Just while we're in the area of writing, can I ask you a little bit about CBA2, the collection of the student texts? What does the collection of student texts look like in your context, in your practice for your students?
So for me, I would say from the start of second year right through to third year, any larger assignment that we do, I look at it as a piece for the collection of texts. So I just feel that process of drafting and editing is something that they like, it's really important, not only for secondary school, but when they go into university, that idea of writing an essay or putting together a piece or making sure that something is drafted, edited, and then completed is so important. So any assignment I set between second year and third year, I would see as a possible piece for the portfolio. And we do a lot of emphasis on the drafting and editing. And we do peer editing then as well. I think that's really important. Like sometimes they learn more from the person next to them and how they've done something than they learn from what I've put on the screen. So I would feel that, like I missed it. We did CBA1 for the last 2 years instead of CBA2. We chose the oral communication task, but we still continued to do the pieces. So we still continue to collect it. And I just feel there's opportunity to collect a piece with anything that you're doing. It might be poetry or it might be Shakespeare. Like I know the lads have done poems for Romeo and Juliet. They've done articles for Romeo and Juliet. They've done all kinds of everything for Romeo and Juliet. But you don't have to stick with it. It didn't have to be necessarily a piece they thought was going to come out of Romeo and Juliet. We did a prescription at one stage, just Romeo goes with his prescription for the poison, what is it, you know, those kind of things. I just think any opportunity to write something and be creative is really important. It doesn't have to be a short story or it doesn't have to be something completely creative. Like I've one kid in the class who knows every fact about Romeo and Juliet, everything, to the point like he knows how many words are in the full text and all of that kind of thing. So it's great to be able to give a student like that an opportunity to write an article about the facts that you know. So I would always try and give multiple choices in terms of what I'm asking them to write so that students can find an area that they like. And then they're doing their assignment on an area they like. So homework is always multiple options for me, especially in terms of writing, because not everyone's a creative writer. Someone is factual. And much and all as I make them do the creative writing, I also want them an opportunity to do things that they're good at and they can show off at. So multiple choices is always good for homework.
And all of those variety of genres that you've just mentioned there, is that kind of one of the top ways that you encourage your students to engage in a variety of genres, by giving them lots of different options and kind of encouraging them to pick maybe even beyond the one that maybe they completed the last time and to try something different and to see how they get on with it, see what their thoughts are around it?
I would spend a lot of time in second year giving multiple options, but by third year, a student will know what they're really good at. And I think that it's very important, especially because we would have students skip from third year straight into fifth year, that students know what they're good at and what they enjoy, especially for paper one in terms of the composition. Knowing that you're an essay or a short story writer is important, because sometimes choice can be difficult on an exam day and some of them pick the wrong option. So I liked to offer lots in second year and then to hone skills in third year. So while they'll have tried everything and they'll have practiced everything in third year, then we start giving them the opportunity to really show off their ability. And I always try to make it something that they enjoy. So if a kid hates writing short stories, get them to write a couple, but then let them do the thing that they like, because if they do the thing that they like, they'll do it well and they'll do it better. Their ability and what they are good at is important as well in the English class, I think.
Do you ever model the writing process with them?
Yes. And I think it's really important. Like for flash fiction, I always do it as well. They're in stitches because some of the things I come up with, they think I'm absolutely nuts, I think. But in the classroom as well, if we're doing a question, if we're doing an article, if we're doing a short story, I will always show them my version and then I'll always show them a sample version. I think it's really important too, because when you write on the board, sometimes you get spellings wrong when you're so close to it and you're writing quickly. And I think it's good for them to see that as teachers, sometimes we get it wrong too, that I have to edit and I have to draft and I have to read back over something to make sure it makes sense and all of those. I think that's a really like positive way to model, because nobody's perfect and nobody is going to write it perfectly the first time. It really feeds into that idea of drafting and editing and making sure you reread what you've written.
It helps to take the daunting nature of sharing your work with students, because there is an expectation there that the work should be perfect and, oh, this is the teacher's answer, it should be absolutely spot on, there should be no mistakes. So even community editing there, as we spoke about earlier, it's a really nice way of making that a safe space so that the students are involved in it with you.
Definitely. I have a sign up in my school that are up in my classroom that says failure teaches us more than success. And I just truly believe it. Like I always say to the lads, like, look, do you have this here that's really good? And if we work on that, sometimes getting it wrong is a better learning experience than getting it completely right. Like you have to work through that. And I just feel like I get it wrong lots in the classroom, but it's good for them to see that like you can fix that and you can work through that and you can learn through that. And I think that's really important. And with COVID as well, like lots of them were working with us through screens at the very start. And I just like the idea that it makes us more human for them, that it's okay to get things wrong because the teacher also gets things wrong.
And I ask you a little bit in relation to debating. Does debating ever appear in your classroom or in relation to topics or questions?
So we wouldn't have formal debating in our class, but we do walking debates and things like that. So we use Jamboard actually for our debating, which is helpful. So like I would say definitely before we start a new topic, like I said with this one summer, if a controversial topic or something comes up, we will debate that. What do you think about this? You know, how do you feel about that? So we did start with the walking debates and the physical post-its, but Jamboard is great because the post-its don't have to be collected at the end of the class. They're kept on the Jamboard and you can add it to the Google Classroom afterwards. So we would regularly set that up and students would just put their name on the end of the post-it if they wish on Jamboard. If they don't, they get to make their comment anonymously. And I feel sometimes that helps. I see who's putting the comment up, but the rest of the students can actually say something that they want to say without feeling they're being judged by the rest of the class. So I've found Jamboard really beneficial. And as I said, you have a copy of the debate and the comments made straight into the Google Classroom afterwards, which is great because you can work with that then for homework. You know, these are the comments that came out today. What do you think of this or what do you think of that? So it's been really helpful. Yeah, COVID has brought us lots of that we wouldn't have had before.
Like in some ways, I suppose it has shone a light on different digital technologies out there that might help support certain activities in the classroom. Do students in your school have devices?
No, so we are a phone-free school, so they don't even have their phones, which is brilliant. They're not too impressed by it, but it is brilliant because they're offline all day unless the teacher specifically gives them a device. We have access to trolleys for our classrooms, so we have iPads, Chromebooks and laptops. So you can book them like you would book a library or you book them for the class. I would book them maybe once or twice a month, maybe more depending on what we're doing. So my first years have had them constantly for the last 2 weeks because we've been doing an oral communication project. So they're working on that. But in the classroom, no, we've no devices generally. Now, I have a device. I have a Surface Pro that links to the whiteboard, which means that as I'm writing on the board, I'm actually down around with the kids, which means that if they have a question, I'm next to them, but I'm still writing on the board, which is really good. I find it really beneficial. It's one of the major things in IT that I found has made a difference to my teaching because firstly, I don't have to turn my back to write on the board. I can literally face them and write on the board on the Surface Pro. But also it means that I don't have to be at the board or at my desk to move a presentation or anything like that. I'm down amongst them and in around them. And it's been brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Can I ask you a little bit about poetry in your classroom? And I suppose some of the regular feedback that we get is in relation to trying to engage students in poetry, trying to spark interest for them, trying to make it relevant to their lives as well. How does this work for you? Are there any particular poems that you find this one really works well and students respond to it?
I think the minute students hear poetry, I think they think about sonnets and things like that. And I always feel there's an in. You need to know your class. As I said, I never choose my texts or my poems until I've actually met the class and I know what they're interested in. I think music is probably one of the best ways to get into poetry. Like Dermot Kennedy is a poet. You know, they just happen to put music and he happens to sing it. But I just feel music, definitely with the first years, like at the moment, that oral communication task that they're doing is their favorite song. And then they're looking for poetic techniques in their favorite song. So we haven't touched a poem yet. We're just looking at songs. I think that makes it a little bit more accessible. I just always feel you have to find something that will buy them into it. Sometimes I never touch the poem for the first class. I won't even show it to them. We might do the background and then I'll show them the poem because I think understanding the meaning of a poem before you ever get there helps them to get over the idea that this is written funny or it's strange language or it's all of those kind of things. So I would always try and get them in before you bring the poem in.
Do you find that they're prepared then when they meet some of the prescribed poetry at senior cycle? And if you're approaching that kind of poetry, are there any little things that you do differently than if you were approaching a poem, as you mentioned there, for example?
Before you start is really important. And I would say their terms, like knowing the poetic terms, like my first years get a poetic glossary into their Google Classroom and it's in their materials. And that gets transferred over every year. Each year, then we highlight the ones that we're focusing on for the year. But by third year, they have them all. So when they go on to fifth year, I throw back in the poetry glossary. This is what we're doing. So I just think that idea, like the vocab is really important. Lots of them will be able to say, oh, look, there's a beat here. But being able to label it and give the vocab is really important. So we do focus on that poetic glossary from first year. And by the time they get to Leaving Cert, then I'm hoping it's second nature to them. It's easier for them to recall.
Particularly in light of the last number of months, the last number of years, can I ask about your experience with EAL and students who might have English as an additional language? Are there students that have English as an additional language present in your classroom? And are there any particular strategies or resources that you use when you're approaching trying to support learning for those students?
So we would have a large number of Syrian and Ukrainian students in our school. I suppose our concern was lots of them are coming into third year or sixth year. And we were really concerned at the idea that they were here and immediately into a state exam. So we've been using PowerPoint's translation. So if you give a live presentation in your PowerPoint, you can have subtitles in the translated language. But students would also be given a device. So if you have more than one language in the class, they can sign into the presentation and the subtitles are in their chosen language then. So the individual students would be given that. We're also working on keywords at junior cycle And we have an EAL Google sheet that translates the keywords in the class. And I find they've been very helpful, especially when you're doing things like poetry and you are talking about poetic techniques and things like that. Some of the words are very difficult. And I've found there's no way of really trying to explain them. It's much easier if they can translate it. And then they're like, oh yeah, I totally get it. So those Google sheets that we have, the Google spreadsheet is really good. And it will translate across the board. So if you have Arabic, Russian, Ukrainian and Polish in your class, it'll do all four words for you, and they have them. So all the kids get that, and that's their keyword sheet in terms of revision for their exams and things like that. But it's been really helpful, really, really helpful.
Finally, as we come to the last topic of the conversation, I just wanted to ask about non-literary texts. So maybe media or visual posters or social media or advertisements. Are there any pieces that you use that you find are particularly helpful and that your students engage with well?
I love John Lewis. So we do advertising late November every year. Advertising is in there. So we do the John Lewis ads and Christmas ads. So we look at print media for Christmas ads. We look at the Barry's Tea ad for the audio ads. And then we look at the John Lewis ads for TV ads. So we do all of that. And the kids get all hyped up because it's coming up to Christmas and they're invested. The nice thing is when I have it timed like that, the new John Lewis ad will come out just as we're finishing. And then we get to analyze and take that apart when it comes out. That Barry's Tea ad is brilliant as well because it's audio and they're not expecting it. And most of them won't have heard it before. How, I don't know, because it's on the radio in Ireland all the time, but they tell me they don't listen to the radio. But I've just found that really good. And I would do it in second year. And the third years asked me this year in November, Miss, can we revise advertising, please? So they were looking forward to going through it again. Obviously, there's new ads come out each year. So that was the justification from the third years this year. There were new ads we could analyze. So we had to go and revise advertising.
They're probably exposed to all sorts of different advertising through social media and their digital means that they get it from. So it's lovely to be able to combine both the audio and the visual, try and draw out those skills as well. Patricia, thanks so much. It's been absolutely lovely getting this opportunity to chat with you. So much happening in your practice, so much happening in your school. And thanks for taking the time to share a little snapshot or a little insight into what works well for you and for your students.
No problem. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode. You can find out more on our SoundCloud channel or by searching for Junior Cycle Talks wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. You can also find out more on our website, jct.ie/English.